I'll call this meeting to order of the Agriculture and Rural Development Finance Committee. There's a quorum present. I call on Representative Marquardt for a motion regarding the minutes, if you would, please.
Madam Chair, I move approval of the minutes.
Any discussion? Now we'll proceed to vote. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion carries. The minutes are approved. Today we're going to focus our committee's attention on a very hot topic in the livestock industry, one that's raised considerable concerns and numerous issues regarding dealing with the public and assuring the public of a safe, healthy food source, namely, in this case, the beef supply in our state and nation. I'd like to thank the presenters in advance who will be presenting on the issue of bovine spongiform encephalopathy. And I'd like first to call Dr. Bill Hartman forward for a presentation. He is representing the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. He's their executive director.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, there's been a slight change to the order, and so Kevin Elfring is going to start off the presentation.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Elfring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Elfring. I'm the Interim Director of Dairy, Food, and Meat Inspection for the Department of Agriculture.
Thank you, Mr. Elfring.
Madam Chair, we decided we would put together a little presentation. So there's kind of, we have one presentation for all three of us. So
very good.
And we can proceed. We'll go right ahead.
Please do.
So we're going to be talking today a little bit about an issue that is very significant, relating to not only the animal livestock industry, but also in relationship to public health, and that's bovine spongiform encephalopathy, which is really a concern that occurred a few years ago, especially in Britain. And we're going to be talking today a little bit about some of the public health implications, the animal health implications, and also some of the proposed rules that have been recently submitted for a comment by both the USDA and the Food and Drug Administration. BSE, or bovine spongiform encephalopathy, is part of a family of diseases that are just considered to be transmissible spongiform encephalopathies. There's a number of them in animals listed there: BSE, scrapie, chronic wasting disease. There's also a mink encephalopathy, and in exotic ruminants, and there's also a feline spongiform encephalopathy. There's also human encephalopathies, Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. It's a sporadic cases and occurs mainly in older people. There's a Gertzmann-Strasser-Shanker syndrome and also a fatal familiar insomnia. And there's also another one called kudu, which is really a disease that's found in some of the tribes from cannibalism. There's other concern is also from the implications with BSE is a variant, Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. It's a new form of a human transmissible spongiform encephalopathy. It's probably caused by the same agent or the prion with BSE. The patients are a lot younger than the sporadic cases, and the clinical signs are different. There is a longer duration of the illness, too. Variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease has been found in a number of countries, especially in the United Kingdom. There has been one case in the United States, but that person who contracted the disease had lived most of her life in Great Britain. These were the cases in the United Kingdom from 1995 to 2001. Did rather peak at the in the year 2000, and they're seeing a considerable drop in the numbers of cases. Just a little one slide here that shows the difference in age, mainly between the new variant. The average age is 29 years old, where the sporadic cases are in older persons, usually around 60. What is a TSE? It's the It's transmissible, meaning that it can be transmitted from animal to animal, animal to human, and also human to human in some cases, in relationship to organ transplants. Spongiform, it describes the appearance of the tissue, especially the brain gives an appearance to have holes in the brain, or more like a sponge. Encephalopathy, meaning that it affects the brain. The cause is an agent called a prion. It's actually a misshapen protein. You have normal proteins in all mammals, and this one is converted to an abnormal shape and called the prion. It has no genetic material. The aberrant protein then corrupts other, what are called protease-resistant proteins, not by replication, but rather by conversion, and it causes brain degeneration. This is just a little photo of, or a little film clip of a normal protein as it is converted into this aberrant form of the prion. The infected prion then can affect other proteins in the body. Just another slide of the normal protein and then the prion. This next video clip just shows how these prions then form a chain and can actually then corrupt the entire system, and especially the brain and other nerve tissue in the body. Some of the epidemiology of TSEs is a little bit, there are different transmissions based on some of the various species. Scrapie is usually contact with infected placenta and has some genetic susceptibility. Chronic wasting disease in cervids is most likely obtained from a contaminated environment. Kudu is in some of the ritualistic cannibal countries, especially Aborigines, where they eat the human brains of their ancestors. Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease is primarily spontaneous, and there are some hereditary forms. There are some transmission, especially through iatrogenic transplantations, especially there was found to be in with cornea transplants, even with surgical equipment that had been autoclaved, still did not destroy the prion. The diagnosis of TSEs, there's really no gross brain abnormalities. You see the it's actually through microscopy where you see vacuoles or holes in the brain. You have an accumulation of these normal prions, and then the identification is done through a special ELISA or Western blot examination. This is actually a slide of that examination with the microscope to show those vacuoles in the brain. The most likely route of exposure from bovines to humans is the consumption of highly infective tissues. In Britain, they use a system called mechanically separated meat products, where there are probably likely spinal cord tissue that was intermingled in muscle tissue. And these products were most likely used in hot dogs, sausages, meat pies, things like that. Less likely would be contamination of muscle. The prion has never been found to be found in muscle tissue. There also could have been some contamination from brain tissue in the stunning techniques that are being used or were used in Great Britain. Or there is a potential cross-contamination of the slaughterhouse and processing tools. I'm going to turn this over now to Dr. Hartman, and he is going to go over more of the clinical signs with TSE.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and the State Veterinarian.
Welcome, Dr. Hartman.
Thank you. I'd like to focus my presentation today on three items. I'll give you a brief description of BSE, or bovine spongiform encephalopathy. I'll talk a little bit about where the disease has been found in the world, and lastly talk about what the United States has done to protect us from this disease. Bovine spongiform encephalopathy is a progressive fatal disease of the nervous system of cattle, and if you look at this picture of this cow, it's exhibiting one of the classical symptoms. This disease affects the brain and the spinal cord, and that animal is clumsy, essentially. It's a loss of coordination, or ataxia that we call it. So, and it's oftentimes in the rear legs that the animal becomes clumsy. This is an unusual disease in that when an animal is exposed to the organism that causes it, it takes between 3 and 6 years before it shows any signs of the disease. So during that period of time, there's no way of knowing whether the animal has the disease or not, and so far anyway, there's no way to test these animals also to find out if they have it. This picture I have is of a cow that, one of the things with this disease, one of the symptoms is if a cow has it and you flap your hands or make a loud noise around it, they become startled, and this is trying to depict that where the eyes are real big. That's another symptom that we'll see with it. Abnormal posture, lack of coordination, and difficulty rising. I mentioned that lack of coordination before. The reason the disease got nicknamed mad cow disease in the United Kingdom is because a very small percentage of the animals that have this disease exhibit aggressive behavior. So that's the link to mad cow disease. The only way that we're aware of that this disease can be transmitted is through the feed. So an animal, I could be sitting next to Kevin Elfring and I could not give him the disease, but if we ate some common food, if cattle eat common food, then that's how they get the disease. So it's unlike foot and mouth disease or many of the other diseases that we've talked about, in that it can't spread from animal to animal and cause epidemics that way. The only way animals can get exposed to it are eating contaminated feed. The talk a little bit about the BSE epidemic in the United Kingdom, and it truly was an epidemic. Scientists speculate that the reason that this happened is BSE originated when scrapie jumped the species barrier through contaminated feed to infect cattle. So the United Kingdom has kind of a unique situation. They have a lot of sheep. They have a fair number of sheep that have scrapie, as Kevin said, another TSE of animals. So this is a disease that affects sheep. And when those animals were rendered, then that prion protein wasn't destroyed by the rendering process, and they speculate that that TSE then cause disease in cattle or BSE. This chart shows the depiction of the epidemic curve in the United Kingdom. It's cases by month and by year. And you can see the outbreak of BSE in the United Kingdom started in 1986, was the first case that was diagnosed. It reached its peak in 1992 with over 1,000 cases per month. And you can see they're still finding a few cases, but because of the safeguards they put in place in the United Kingdom, the number that they are detecting monthly has gone way, way, way down. Just a few isolated cases now. During that epidemic, over 180,000 head of cattle on 45,000 farms were found infected with BSE. And one other point on that, most of those animals were dairy cattle. So there have been some beef cattle found infected, but in the United Kingdom anyway, most of them were dairy animals. This map of the world just shows where we see the disease in the world. The pink countries are countries that have had an animal that tested positive for the disease, and that animal was born in that country. So you can see that most of the of Europe, Japan, and Canada have had indigenous cases of BSE. I'll emphasize, though, that the majority of these cases are in the United Kingdom. The other countries, very small numbers. For instance, Canada's only had two cases, two positive animals. And then the United States is tan in color because we've had a positive case, but it was imported from another country. talk a little bit about the two positive animals that have been found in Canada. The first one was in 1993, so quite a while ago. Most people aren't aware of this one. It was a single cow that was found infected, but it was an import from the United Kingdom. So the feeling is that that animal was exposed to the agent before it left the United Kingdom and was positive in Canada. And that's significant because that means the feed that was contaminated was in the United Kingdom rather than in Canada. The second case was in May of 2003. That was a six-year-old Angus beef cow, which was a little unusual that it was a beef animal rather than a dairy animal, and was found in northern Alberta. That case was investigated and led to 40 herds being quarantined in Canada and about 2,700 head of cattle that were depopulated and tested. Those animals all tested negative. So that means that in Canada so far there have been two animals that have tested positive for BSE. It's not exactly an epidemic, it's just two animals. In the United States, the Secretary of Agriculture announced on December 23rd, I remember I was in Florida, that the first case of BSE was found in the United States. It was found on routine surveillance, so this was not an animal that was showing clinical signs of BSE, it was just the routine surveillance we do at slaughter. The cow was traced back with an ID to a herd, a dairy herd in Mapton, Washington, and I put this map on so you could get some idea where this is all going on. That it's kind of hard for you to see the map very well, but Mapton, Washington is in south central Washington. During the investigation in Washington, they used a health certificate and DNA evidence to trace, to verify that this animal that was slaughtered, tested positive for BSE, was originally from a herd in Canada, and that was in Calmar, Canada, and I'll go back to that map. That Calmar, Canada, or Alberta, is just southeast of Edmonton, if you can see Edmonton on there. It's not, you're kind of a long ways away from it. But anyway, so they used DNA evidence and this health certificate showing this ID on this animal coming into Canada in 2000, or from Canada to the United States in 2001. During the investigation, they found 255 animals of interest on 10 different premises in 3 different states. All of those animals were depopulated and tested, and they all tested negative for BSE. So in the United States then, just during this whole investigation, just one animal tested positive. And that animal was traced to its birth herd in Canada, and that's significant in that we, because of the incubation period of this disease, the most likely place that this animal was exposed to contaminated feed and got the disease is that birth herd in Canada. Oh, and I was in Washington, D.C. when they announced Monday that they've completed the investigation and they won't be doing any further tracing or testing in Washington. Just a little bit now about how what we're doing in the United States to protect the human health and the animal health from this disease. We've instituted import controls. Second is a surveillance. Third is an animal feed ban. Fourth, protecting the human food supply. And fifth, response planning. And I'll go into a little bit more detail on the three of those firewalls that apply to the Board of Animal Health and that we work with. And then Kevin and Doug will talk about the two that apply to them. First, import controls. There's two things you need to do with this disease. One is to keep it, if you don't have it in a country, keep the organism from coming into the country from a country that has it. And secondly, if you do have it, the feed ban, so that you're not feeding this organism back to animals and amplifying it, because that's how they get the disease. So in 1989, which is almost 15 years ago now, the United States banned the import of any ruminants or ruminant products from countries that have BSE. So ruminants being cattle, sheep, and goats, those sorts of animals that have rumens for stomachs. As far as surveillance goes, we're doing a targeted surveillance in the United States, and our numbers have always exceeded what the international requirements are. That targeted surveillance is animals that are showing nervous system disorders or cattle that are non-ambulatory, or as you've heard them referred to as downer cattle. The reason that we're doing that targeted surveillance is what they've learned in Europe about this disease, and that is they did surveillance in this targeted group, and when they did that, they found one-third of the animals that they tested positive for BSE. So one-third of all the animals in this targeted group were positive. When they did the normal population of cattle that weren't showing, that were ambulatory and weren't showing central nervous system disorders, they found less than 0.01% positive. So they weren't finding very many positives that way, and they estimated that it would cost $2.2 million to find one BSE-infected animal. So it wasn't a very cost-effective way of discovering the disease. If you look at the chart on the right here, it shows the surveillance numbers for the United States from 1990, when we tested 40 brains for BSE, to 2003, in which 20,526 were tested. Minnesota has done a very good job of contributing to that surveillance. Over the last federal fiscal year, we contributed about 10% of the samples that were submitted nationwide. And that surveillance is, hopefully we can maintain that. The changes with the downer cattle that we're going to talk about in a minute, that's one of the reasons that we were so successful in our surveillance here in Minnesota. Response planning, we've been working with the Department of Agriculture here in Minnesota, the USDA, and the FDA to respond if there were a case of BSE in Minnesota. You know, when you do surveillance for disease, the dilemma is that sometimes you find it. Washington found that out. So we need to be prepared if we should get a positive case here in Minnesota. The Secretary of Agriculture appointed a international review team to look at what we've done in the United States since we found this positive animal. And it's a 7-page report. I'm not going to go through everything that's in the report, but I'll point out some key things they found in this report. Firstly, they said that even though this cow traces back to Canada and probably the feed source that was contaminated, that infected it, was from Canada, that there's an integration of the feed and cattle industries in North America, so they consider this a North American problem, not just a Canada problem. And they also believe that we will find additional cases in the United States. Now, this is not USDA. This is a review panel, an international review panel that looked at it. Some additional points they made, I think they came out with that this investigation that was done in Washington was very effective. They said the epidemiologic investigation was in line with international standards. Tracing of rendered product was effective and appropriate. Recall of the meat was in line with the World Health Organization's recommendations. The one thing that they pointed out was that one of the reasons it was so difficult to trace these animals in Washington was because of limitations of our animal ID system. Now, the Secretary of Agriculture knew that. She already announced a couple of weeks prior to that that it would become a top priority for USDA to implement this United States Animal Identification Plan. And what this plan is a plan that USDA, the states, and livestock industry have been working on for the last 2 years to do what Canada has started implementing as well, an identification program to identify animals as they move through our livestock markets and go to slaughter. This identification plan is a three-phase plan. It starts with identifying, giving an identity number to every livestock operation in the United States. So every premise that has livestock on it in the United States would have a number to it. The second phase is that all animals, if they're breeding animals, individuals, if they're feeder animals, lots of animals would have an identification on them when they moved in interstate commerce. And that would require some law changes to the federal laws. And then the last phase to it is identifying individual breeding animals or feeder lots that move intrastate, and that would require changes to the Board of Animal Health rules. Madam Chair, that's the completion of my part, and I turn it back to Kevin Elfring.
Madam Chair,
thank you.
I'll continue on with the food safety issues and protecting the food supply. There's a few things that are being proposed or in right now as interim final rules, both by FDA and USDA. Some of them relating to food, some in cosmetics. Really trying to prevent these potentially infected tissues from entering the human food channels. There are four interim final rules that were put in place by USDA very recently, one pertaining to surveillance, and another a prohibition of specified risk materials in non-ambulatory animals. Also another on advanced meat recovery systems and mechanically separated meat products and equipment, and then also the use of stunning devices for the slaughter process. First of all, I'll talk about surveillance. As Dr. Hartman mentioned, we've had a very good surveillance program for a number of years. Veterinary Services, APHIS, will still continue to have a surveillance program, as well as our department. The thing that's been put in place right now with the first interim final rule is that all of those carcasses that are tested for VSE are going to be held and retained until the results of those tests are back before they can be used for going into the human food channels. All samples are sent to the National Veterinary Services Laboratory in Ames, Iowa. Our state inspection program also samples. We obtain brain stems for APHIS, and they also get sent to the same laboratory. And all of the carcasses will be retained until the results are back. Downer cattle and specified risk materials. Right now, non-ambulatory cattle are prohibited from the human food channels. Anything that it can considered downer cannot be brought into the slaughter plant. There are some conditions if the animal is injured once it received, if it's injured once it's been received by the plant and in lairage, that those could still possibly be slaughtered if they have already gone through an antemortem inspection. It also includes animals that are brought into custom exempt processing plants that don't have an inspector on site, that do not have antemortem and postmortem inspection. The interim final rule right now by USDA does not allow for any non-ambulatory animals to go into any slaughter plant. Farm dress carcasses, even if they're slaughtered on the farm and brought into a processing plant, cannot be accepted by the plant unless the operator is given some assurances that this was not a downer animal. One of the things with custom exempt processing, it really has become a rather contentious issue. USDA considers that all non-ambulatory animals are adulterated. Our department's position in what we're going to be actually commenting on is that these animals should still be allowed to be used by the owner of the animal. That if an animal is obviously injured, should still be allowed to go to a custom processing plant for slaughtering and brought back for the farmer's own consumption and for their family's consumption. Of course, suspect animals that are non-ambulatory should never be used. If you have an animal that's perfectly healthy one day and is down the next day for no apparent reason, probably should not be used in human food. Specified risk materials, these just kind of a little graphic here of where these risk materials that we talk about all the time with the spinal cord, the brain, the trigeminal ganglia, dorsal root ganglia, the distal ileum, and the retina are really considered specified risk materials. Bone marrow is on there. It has been experimentally shown that the prion can be in bone marrow, but it doesn't naturally occur in bone marrow. So that is not considered to be a specified risk material. Specified risk materials are prohibited materials in meat products. It varies a little bit on the age of the cattle. Any cattle over 30 months of age, all materials are considered to be the SRMs. In animals that are less than 30 months of age, only the tonsils and small intestines are considered to be the SRMs. Now, tonsils have never been considered to be edible material, but it still is listed as one of the specified risk materials. What really are they? If you look at a T-bone steak and you look right on the top of the T, that is spinal cord material. So that is a specified risk material. And any cattle that are slaughtered that are over 30 months of age have to have that spinal cord removed. Small intestines from cattle, for those of you who eat ring bologna with natural casings, that is made from the small intestine. That's the casing that's used. And the reason that that is considered a specified risk material is because of the distal ileum, which is part of the small intestine. One of the things that we do when we train our plants and our inspectors on is using dentition to identify the age of cattle, be able to determine what the cattle are at least 30 or more months of age. One thing is a little footnote is that the majority of the cattle that are used for primal and subprimal cuts, steaks, roasts, are much younger animals, usually between 14 and 16 months. Those are the typical animals that are going for primal cuts. Cattle that are greater than 30 months of age are usually used in ground beef or in sausage manufacturing. Just using dentition.
Could I ask a question,
Madam Chair?
What percentage of the cattle slaughtered in the United States, processed in the United States, are less than 30 months of age?
Madam Chair, Representative Maggs, I don't know. I don't know that right offhand. Maybe Steve Brake with the Minnesota Cattlemen's Association.
Over 30 months of age. 20% of the cattle killed in the United States are over 30 months of age.
I thought it was 15, but I don't want to argue with one of my constituents.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, with using dentition, the second permanent incisor, because cattle have deciduous and permanent teeth, they're able to identify cattle at 30 months of age by looking at that second permanent incisor. Products that are considered to be a concern for exposure would be like rib steaks or roast T-bone steaks because of the spinal cord and the dorsal root ganglia. Advanced meat recovery systems because of the spinal cord. Head meats because of any potential brain leakage. Sausage casings, the distal ileum and ground products, of course, with brain, spinal cord, or dorsal root ganglia. Mechanically separated meat products. The next interim final rule prohibits the use of mechanically separated beef. It really has never been used in the United States. It was used in Great Britain, but really what that system is it kind of simultaneously grinds the bone and meat together, and then the meat and adipose tissue is forced through a sieve, and it almost is like a paste that is used. But it has never been really used in the United States in the beef industry. It is used in the poultry industry, though. Advanced meat recovery systems are used in the United States, and they remove adhering meat tissue from bones using either high air pressure or rubber fingers. One of the things is this interim final rule states that meat from advanced meat recovery systems cannot contain any specified risk materials, and if they do, they're condemned. Really only large plants operate these AMR systems. Studying of animals, another interim final rule is prohibiting the use of pneumatic stunners. And pneumatic stunners, again, are really not used in the United States. They did use them at a time where they would inject air into the brain at the same time that they were using a captive bull. It created a more effective stunning, but they also found that they had found brain tissue in the lungs and even in the cardiac muscle with using this pneumatic stunning, and that has not been used in the United States for a number of years. Captive bolt stunning is allowed, but if there is any brain leakage, the head is condemned, where they can't use any of the meat off of the head. We are doing a lot of training for plant operators and meat inspection personnel, providing them the educational materials and training, showing how to remove spinal cord material from carcasses, and helping them reassess their HACCP plans to include BSE as a potential hazard. One of the things is that these additional responsibilities are stretching a pretty already stretched program. Presently, we can't add any more plants to state inspection because we don't have the necessary personnel to be able to cover those plants. I'm going to turn it over now to Doug Luters, and he is going to talk about the feed issues related to a lot of the BSE rules.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Luters.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Would you state your name for the record, please?
I'm Doug Luters. I am the supervisor for the commercial feed unit with Minnesota Department of Ag.
Thank you.
The animal feed ban was implemented in Minnesota, or in the nation, in 1997. And Minnesota was one of the four lead states at taking upon themselves in the Department of Ag to go out and enforce and educate the prohibition of mammalian protein in ruminant animals, including cattle. As you know from earlier in the presentation, the only way that BSE is spread through the herd is via infected animals being rendered or produced into feed, which is then again fed to ruminants. Back in 97, which would be your fiscal year 98 on this chart, when we first started enforcing the rule in Minnesota, we were not under FDA contract. In years after 97, in 98, we effected contracts with FDA, and we inspected for prohibited mammalian tissue being used in feed under their contract. As you can see, the industry has done very well in compliance in this matter. Back in 98, fiscal year 98, when we started our inspections, only about 61% of the locations that we visited were in compliance with the feed ban. That went up and increased by 15% the following year, another 10% the following year. And since fiscal year 2001, the industry has basically been in compliance with the feed ban. As you can see, year to date, in fiscal year 2004, there's 100% compliance with the feed ban in Minnesota. Some of the things that have changed with FDA recently here, they have issued the interim final rule changes, which would ban the following from the human food, dairy supplements, and cosmetics. In that ban, through FDA, all downer cattle materials banned, all dead cattle material, specified risk materials, and mechanically separated beef. Following this interim final rule, there was a second one issued here early in February. And that also contained four specific changes pertaining specifically to ruminant feed. Number one was banning mammalian blood and blood products, with the exception of porcine and equine blood and blood products, from ruminant feeds. And this, one of the main reasons, one of the main places this was used, was it was used as a dried additive to calf feeds. And industry or research has shown over the years that one of the most susceptible times for the infection to happen is in young ruminants. Another reason for the ban on this is that to be able to chemically confirm whether ruminant whether ruminant material is present in a food or feed product, you cannot have the exempted things still there and tell that the rest of it's not there. So by banning blood products, the following, poultry litter, which also may contain prohibited mammalian tissue because it was included in poultry feed, and plate waste, which would come from institutions and restaurants, that you couldn't, again, not tell that the positive was not coming from the exempted mammalian tissue rather than prohibited. So These prohibitions help be able to scientifically test whether there is prohibited mammalian tissue present or not. And the fourth change, which specifically affects probably your constituents, members of the board, is the dedicated feed equipment and facility production lines. And this is a major change into the production of feed, and what it says in this interim rule is that if you are producing a feed product that contains prohibited mammalian tissue, that you cannot produce ruminant feeds through that same feed line. So that will require dedicated production facilities, which would be all the way from the delivery truck that goes to the farm, conveyance, receiving systems, and the production facility itself. In Minnesota, in contract year, or in our fiscal year 2003, Minnesota Department of Agriculture, under contract with FDA on their 21 CFR 589-2000, which is the BSE rule, we did the following feed contract inspections. And as you can see there, in 2003, we did 100 BSE inspections in conjunction with other MDA inspections, which may be feed mill inspections or sampling inspections, 50 BSE inspections without other MDA inspections or standalones, 30 BSE inspections with in conjunction with federally licensed mill inspections. And federally licensed mills are mills that use specific concentration or high potency drugs in their feed manufacturing, as opposed to those that do not. And 40 BSE inspections in excess of our FDA contract. Along with that, we did 14 BSE inspections along with our FDA tissue residue contract for a total of 234 in fiscal year 2003. Of those 234, we found two locations that were not in compliance with the feed ban rules, and those compliances were involving their record keeping, not their production practices. In fiscal year 2004, current year, we have contracted with FDA for the following contract inspections. These are, we are approximately one half completed with this list of inspections. As you can see, it is very similar to the previous year's inspections, except in two areas. Number one area would be down under 30 BSE inspections with FDA tissue residue inspections. Last year we did 14. So that's increased emphasis, and our tissue residue inspections are done where there has been a hot carcass found at a slaughter plant. Normally that is for medication residues, and so we do the investigative work to find why that carcass was hot. In the process of doing that investigative work for the FDA, we also do BSE inspections. And the other big change is the one right below that, which is 20 elective non-manufacturing inspections. And those inspections would include renderers, distribution places, and also those inspections can include inspections at the production level or the producer level. So that will get us to the farm. So that is a total of a scheduled 230 inspections for BSE with FDA. I have recently applied for a contract amendment which would increase those 20 elective non-manufacturing inspections to 150. However, those would fall technicality, but the contract year, it's fiscal year 2004 for the feds, but those contracts will probably be done in our fiscal year 2005 in July, August, and September. Minnesota Commercial Feed Unit has also proposed some feed rule revisions for this year. And there are three main thrusts to that rule proposal update. Number one is technical corrections. Minnesota Commercial Feed Law or statute was revised in the late 1990s. As you are well aware, rules are to explain the statute. Our rules, most of them date back to the 70s. So there are some technical things, literally where sections of statute are cited in the rule, which no longer are applicable. And even some CFR references at the federal level have changed, so they're no longer applicable. We're looking to update that. The other thing we're looking to do is adopt by reference the federal feed ban, which is 21 CFR 589-2000. With the adoption of the federal feed ban, that will give the commercial feed unit access to the production process controls of feed mills. Prior to this point, under our own statutes, we were only allowed to search for misbranding or mislabeling and adulterated feeds. So the burden of the proof laid upon the department to be able to find if the feed was actually adulterated or not. Now we'll be able to follow up with process controls on our own, in our own rules. And also the adoption by text of the AFCO model regulations for pet and specialty food, which would bring us into alignment with most of the rest of the nation. Literally at this point, if a party that wished to sell pet food in Minnesota were to follow our statute or rule to the letter, they would be out of compliance with the rest of the nation. And vice versa, if they were in compliance with the rest of the nation, they would not technically be in compliance with our rule. In our FDA inspection and our non FDA licensed feed mills in fiscal year 2003, the most frequently observed deviations indicated inadequate records for recall, record keeping, medicated feed not adequately labeled, inadequate storage controls, and drug sources not used in accordance with label directions. And those would be by far the most frequent things observed when we actually visit feed production mills. As far as BSE goes in Minnesota, the observed compliance with the feed ban is currently better than 99%. As my chart showed, it was 100% to date for fiscal year 2004. Minnesota has contracted with FDA to perform these BSE inspections for the upcoming year. And like I indicated, this will be our first year where 10% of our inspections will be done at non-manufacturing sites. One of the main questions we have is how much infected brain material does it take to transmit BSE through the feed? And the dedicated facilities will go a long way with that. But one of our concerns is the ability or how parties that have ever handled prohibited mammalian tissue in the past, how they can clean out and become a dedicated facility in the future. And that is something that the FDA is wrestling with at the national level. What does my commercial feed unit expect? We expect to manufacture distribution of commercial feeds in Minnesota, comply with the Minnesota feed commercial law and rules. And we expect that only correctly labeled animal feeds that are not adulterated are acceptable into distribution. And that wraps up my presentation, Madam Chairman. Here are some websites where much of this information is available. And I also, if there's questions, myself and Kevin.
Thank you, gentlemen. One question to start off. In your opinion, is this just the tip of the iceberg, or what kind of indicators are you seeing?
Madam Chair and representatives, I'll take a stab at that. If you read the report from the International Review Committee, I think it's their opinion that we will find more cases. They didn't elaborate on how many cases that would be. My opinion would be that, you know, we talked about all of the precautions that we've had in the United States for the last 15 years. We haven't allowed the country that would be the greatest risk for us would be the United Kingdom. That's where all the most of the BSE in the world is found. We haven't allowed any live animals, live ruminants, or ruminant products from those countries for 15 years. So there's little likelihood that it could have gotten in from that direction. Now, we have let those animals and products in from Canada, and Canada does a lot more trade with the United Kingdom. So it's potential that there could have been animals or product that got into the United States from that route. But it wouldn't have been a lot. The other thing that Doug talked about is the feed ban that's been in place. So even if an animal did get into the United States since, what was the date, Doug? When was the feed? Since 1997, so that's 7 years, we've prohibited feeding ruminant product to ruminants. So even if the disease was here at a low level, we weren't amplifying it by feeding it back to cattle. So my opinion would be if we do find additional cases, it would be at a fairly low level.
And then, thank you, Dr. Hartman. Mr. Elfring, just a couple of questions. Are there facilities that have asked for state inspection that we've not been able to service with the workload you were talking about?
Madam Chair, yes, quite a few actually. We probably have. We're trying to provide as much service as we can by cross-training some of our other inspectors, but we probably right now have about 20 requests for inspection service that we've not been able to provide.
And then a question on custom processes. Could you expand a bit on that? You indicated federal requirements and the opinion or action or attitude of the MDA?
Madam Chair, one of the difficult situations that we get put into is because we have a state meat inspection program in Minnesota, we're required to follow all the rules of the USDA. And they really pretty much dictate to us on how we're supposed to manage our program. They've made the determination that all non-ambulatory animals are adulterated. My question to them was, do we have the legal authority or the moral authority to be able to tell people what they can and can't eat as far as taking something and processing it in a processing plant and bringing it home for just your own consumption? They believe that they have the authority right now. This is one of the issues that I think is going to receive a lot of comments in this comment period, which closes, I believe, April 12th. And I think you're going to see that's not going to become part of the final rule. But I encourage people to really send in their comments on that issue, because that's what's going to get a change.
Mr. Elfring, how much is the ambulatory issue valid as far as animals that can be processed in those plants? You talked about an animal injured after arrival at the processing facility. We also talked about how the one cow identified in Washington State was ambulatory.
Madam Chair, I think that one of the issues, and Dr. Hartman touched on this, is that what has been sampled in the past has been more of these either non-ambulatory animals or animals that are showing clinical signs of central nervous disorders. That is the population that is most highly suspected. I almost think that this, there's even some question of whether or not this wasn't an ambulatory animal, and there's still some discussion on that. There was just an article that the person who actually stunned the animal is disputing some of the reports.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Hartman or which would be the one to answer, but I was wondering if techniques are being developed or the chances are to develop BSE in live animals before the symptoms are physically evident.
Dr. Hartman.
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, all of the efforts so far to do rapid testing for BSE are in on brain tissue. There hasn't been any other way that they've been able to detect the prions or the disease. So, and to get at that brain, you have to destroy the animals. So there is no work that I know of where they're getting close to finding a test for live animals. Now, that may not continue to be the case, but it's the way it is right now. For instance, in scrapie, in sheep, and in CWD, in deer and elk, there are lymphatic tissues that contain the organism actually, or the prions actually before it's found in the brain. So there may be something like that. With sheep, you can do some testing of the lymphoid tissue in the third eyelid to be able to determine in a live animal whether or not they're positive or not.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Hartman, was it you who indicated that autoclaves do not destroy prions? I wondered what does.
Madam Chair, the prions are pretty resistant to pretty much anything. One of the things that we've done because of that in Minnesota is the Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab is putting in an alkaline digester. So this is a very highly alkaline solution that is then put under great pressure, and it digests carcasses, and that will destroy the prions. So, and then fire at certain temperatures, very high temperatures, will destroy the prion.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Oh, pardon me, Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have a little note here from Representative Dale. He says we have BSC in cows and BS in Freeport, and I'm going to bring up some of that BS in Freeport to Kevin that you can identify with. But anyways, I want to congratulate again Kevin and the Minnesota Department of Ag and their nice program that they started years ago in conjunction with the USDA with the meat processors. I have 8 of them in my district. And I know I had a number of calls on the safety of the BSE and everything else, and I always told them that go to your local meat processor, and he's got locally grown beef, and it's going to be far more safe. You know where it's from? It's from the local farmer. You can not only help him with his business, but you can also help the local producer. But my question has to do with Minnesota's, in regards to their testing, correct me if I'm wrong, I think a percentage of animals, Minnesota was second to Wisconsin on tested animals. I'm wondering now with, and this is some of the numbers I've read, but with the federal mandates coming in, and Representative Harder, you addressed that problem, is it going to affect our local meat processor? You mentioned a little bit about a guy slaughtering a cow for himself, that there might be some change of standards there. The federal program going to affect what we have in play here with the local meat processor?
Mr. Elfring.
Representative Heidgerken, it certainly can. To USDA to see if they really truly have the legal authority to be able to mandate that these animals have to be considered adulterated. So I am really encouraged by a lot of that, that will not be part of the final rule.
Thank you, gentlemen. We'll call two producers. They're not representing producers, they are producers. Mr. Steve Brake, President of the Minnesota Cattlemen's Association, and George Backenberg of the Minnesota Milk Producers Association. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee. I'm Steve Brake. I'm president of the Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association. I'm on the board of directors of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, and this past fall I was appointed by the governor to the Board of Animal Health.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Brake.
Thank you.
Proceed.
Okay. To start out, everything that these three gentlemen talked about are going to cost our industry money, and most of that will come out of my pocket. In this state, beef is a $900 million industry. Recently, there was an article, editorial in the Star Tribune that called that insignificant. I wrote the gentleman who wrote the editorial, and I said that $900 million may be insignificant to someone who lives on concrete, but in rural Minnesota, it's a very vital part of our rural economy. 20% of the U.S. farm income comes from the sale of cattle and calves. For every dollar in cattle sales, $5 of direct economic impact is felt by your local economy. One beef cow standing in a pasture is worth $1,600 in direct economic impact to your local economy. So insignificant, I thought, was a rather harsh word when it comes to our industry. Back in May of 2003, when they found the animal in Canada that was tested positive for BSE, many in our industry wanted to close the borders forever, punish the Canadian producers by not allowing any meat into this country. We took the precautions needed. We supported the closing of the border for a time, but also asked that we need to move ahead on reopening those borders when they proved their meat supply was safe. And the issue of the meat supply being safe was very critical, because I cautioned people when they said that our meat was safer than theirs, is what will we say to other countries and consumers when it happens here? We have to reassure people that it is not a meat safety issue, it's a cattle health issue. And that by saying that beef from Canada was not safe, we run the risk of doing the same here. So be careful what you ask of others, because someday, if it happens here, we were going to be in a critical mess. And when the animal was found on December 23rd that tested positive in the state of Washington, we immediately went to work to reassure consumers that the meat supply was safe. Within 15 minutes of the announcement by USDA, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association held a press conference with 120 news outlets to get that message out to the consumers. They heard that message, because within a week, we took a poll, and there was a 97% awareness by consumers of BSE. And when asked about their confidence in the U.S. beef supply, it was at 89%. Now, that's higher than it was last summer during prime grilling season. Last week, another poll was taken, and it's well over 90% confidence in U.S. beef. So they've gotten the message to consumers in this country that we have a safe beef supply, that the safety of our meat is not an issue when it comes to BSE. As far as I get a lot of questions since it happened about how it affected me financially. On the day, the day before it was announced, cattle were around $92 a hundred. By the next Monday, we were bid $72, a 20% drop in price. That directly reflects to the export market. We export 10% of our production. When you mathematically figure that back into consuming it in our own country and not exporting it, it relates to a 20% drop in price. We saw the prices come back as consumers went back to the stores. They continued to buy meat. Prices got up to as high as $89 a hundred. Yesterday we could have sold cattle for $77. They were up the limit on the board again. So we're seeing some fluctuation yet. A lot of that happened to do with corn prices and soybean prices and the amount of cattle out there and our export market. Some of our export markets have returned. Poland, Russia, Romania have started to import beef again from our country, which is really significant, because a lot of the product that we do not consume in this country is consumed in Russia, for instance, livers, tongues, things like that. But we are hopeful that Mexico will soon open their borders. Japan is a whole other issue. They have, I think, a lot of political unrest as far as handling this problem. They handled it poorly in their country when it happened there, and I think a lot of what they're trying to do to us is making up for what they did not do. They have requested that we test all of our animals that go into the food supply. That's
economically impossible and unnecessary. You heard the gentleman talk about the firewalls and the safeguards that we have in place in this country, and the fact that we have found that one animal in the United States should, I have told people, is a positive message to the consumers that things are working. And that's the only animal we found, and they've decided that there probably isn't any more. So Japan tests all their animals, but that's not hard to do when you only have one packing plant and kill 35 head a day. So in this country, it would be pretty much impossible. On the economic side, the loss of the use of blood from bovine animals relates to about $30 a head. The loss of the small intestine is another $25 a head. That relates to about $180 million loss to our industry a year. But that can be made up. Those are things that we can make up. Just a half a percent of consumer increase in consumer confidence will make up that $180 million. But we got to be able to do that. We got to be able to promote it and get them to increase that consumption. But because of, like I said, the positive message that that we got out, people continue to eat meat. And one thing that was that kind of amazed me was that not one person in this country has ever contracted this disease they attribute to BSE. Not one. But every year, 400 people drown in their own bathtub. Every year, 370 people accidentally hang themselves. And every year, 300 people fall off the stepladder. Yet, no one ever dying from eating meat and getting this disease has ever happened. But a lot of people use this as a stepping stone, as a soapbox, to promote things that they've wanted to done to our industry for some time, mostly anti-meat groups and environmentalists, you know, like the feed bans and increasing those and removing a lot of these materials from the food supply are all things that people have been trying to do in our industry for some time. We support the downer cattle issue as far as going into the regular consumer market. I received many phone calls the day the letter came out from the Department of Ag to our local processing facilities, the mom-and-pop operations in our small towns, because it was on a day that we were loading cattle that we had one 1,300 pounds that anyone here would love to have in their freezer broke its leg. And a normal practice that we do on our farm when that happens is to take that animal, put it out of its misery humanely, and hang it up and then haul it to the processor and have him process it for us for our own consumption. Well, we did this, and when I called him, he said, "Steve, if you would have done it 10 minutes ago, if you would have called me 10 minutes ago, we could have done it. But I'm holding the letter in my hand. I just opened my mail, and they're saying we can't do it." Now, I think this is some of the things that have just gone a little too far when we're telling people we can't consume our own product. I think we're sending the wrong message to consumers when we do that. Because I've been eating an animal with a broken leg, that's about all I got in my freezer, because it happens once in a while. And that animal is perfectly safe. And if we're telling people out there that practices that we've done in the past are not safe, I think we're sending the wrong message. And as far as all the other bans and stuff that are going in place, we've been using those practices for years. But now all of a sudden, we're going to do away with them, and it's going to cost our industry a lot of money. Another topic, people have, I'm sure you've heard of country of origin labeling. People have tried to pass this off as a food safety law recently since BSE was announced. Country of origin labeling would have done nothing to stop the animal from coming into this country, would have not stopped the meat from going into the supply, and would have done nothing to keep this from entering the U.S. and would have not have stopped any of the other countries that we export to from closing their borders. Country of origin labeling is a meat marketing law, and it was passed as such and would have done nothing for food safety. So when people use that, I think they're being dishonest to try to promote a law that they support, but it won't help. 70% of the meat that comes into this country comes in the form of ground beef. That will not be labeled. And if it is labeled, it will be labeled as a product of whatever countries import it into the United States plus U.S. product, because it's all blended. The remaining 30% of the meat that comes into this country, of that, anything that's processed, frozen, cooked, comes in the form of soups or anything that's not in its original form will not be labeled. Anything sold in a deli, anything sold in your cafeteria next door, will not be labeled. Anything sold in a restaurant will not be labeled. So what you have left is about 3% of the meat that's imported into this country as being able to get a label on it. Anything sold in a grocery store that does less than $230,000 worth of business will not be labeled. So it cannot be used as a food safety law, because only 3% of it will be labeled. And so what good will it do? And one of the representatives mentioned that he told his constituents to buy meat from their local processing plant because that'll be safer. My question is, what if one of your constituents comes down with a disease such as BSE? Then what do you tell those people? Because that's why we need to remind people that it's a not a food safety issue, but a cattle health issue, that the food supply remains safe despite finding this one case of BSE. I guess what I want to tell you, the committee, Madam Chair, is that MSCA, Minnesota State Cattlemen, and the National Cattlemen's Beef Association will continue to work tirelessly to reassure Americans and world consumer of the safety of our beef. We will continue to work to reopen closed export markets. We will continue to protect the well-being of Minnesota cattle producers, and I ask you to support us in that effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brake. Mr. Bakerberg, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Thanks for inviting us down. It's been an honor and a pleasure to come down and sit in front of you people and express our opinion of the dairy industry.
Would you introduce yourself for the tape, please?
Sure. My name is George Bakerberg, from Waverly, Minnesota. I'm the president of the Minnesota Milk Producers Association.
Thank you.
First of all, I want to express to everybody that dairy farmers will extra mile take good care of our cows. We work hard, and we do a good, excellent job of maintaining them and giving them a good cow comfort. The one case of BSE in Washington was a great concern to the dairy farmers. 9:30 that morning, I had a call from Tom Rothman. He asked, what's your opinion on this? Are you concerned? Are you worried? About 2 years ago, Channel 11 called me up, and I did a cool sponsor thing with Dr. Tom Haggerty. He was the department head of animal health at that time, and we did a segment that night about the England BSE worry. I said, I'm concerned. I'm not worried, because everything implemented by the U.S. government is in place. This thing will work itself out. We just have to have patience. We work hard to keep our animals healthy. We are in continuous contact with our veterinarians, nutritionists, others, and take proper care of our animals. Overall, we are very pleased with the direct response of the Midwest Dairy Association about milk. They were worried about it was going to get into milk products, and they came on the air. On the Beef Council, they came on the air. Within a few minutes, they were on the air saying, beef is healthy, beef is good. First of all, Minnesota Dairy Association worked with the media to help understand BSE is not transmitted through cows or through the milk. And the Beef Council helped ensure the consumers and the safety of beef. The federal government took media action, and we appreciate the swift movement by USDA. It is important to ensure that food safety in our world, customers, our products are safe. However, they have gone too far too fast. For example, USDA immediately banned all downer cows from slaughter. There's about 40,000 cows a year that do go to slaughter throughout the United States. This seems to be have been done for consumer to protect the consumers alone, because in the areas of these cows can potentially disease infected are not used for human consumption. USDA banned donor cows. There's about 20,000 brain samples a year are taken. 75% of donor cows samples, 75% of these 20,000 animals were taken for brain samples were taken for from these donors for BSC testing. The vast majority of the cows tested were donor cows, and USDA has lost a major source of testing for disease. There's also been a great deal of discussion about a federal identification program. The fact of the matter is that there is ongoing work to develop a sensible identification program on a national basis. The process has been very thoughtful in the development of this program. They have been taking into account of existing identification programs and working to make them more comparable to the national program. Our concern with the USDA knee-jerk reaction to setting up the national identification program immediately is that the decision we made hastily in the long term have negative impacts on dairy industry and to the consumer. You can tell that my comments have been focused on what the federal government is doing to ensure public food safety. This, we believe that the discussion should be continued to take place. Minnesota Milk, along with partners with the federal level and work with the USDA and Congress to address our concerns. At this point, we do not see any immediate need for the state to take a hasty reaction and for an identification program as of yet. But it's important to continue the dialogue between the state and federal agencies, issue of BSE, to ensure that dairy products have dairy producers have the rights are protected while we continue to provide a very, very safe product. And I'd like to thanks again for the doctor, for the previous doctor Eggman and his group here to say that we also believe what is going on with the State Department. And thanks again for the opportunity to testify in front of your people. And big questions, I'll be happy to answer them for you.
Thank you, Mr. Bakerberg. I was wondering if either of you would care to comment on the U.S. Animal Identification Plan.
I know from the dairy part of it, through DHIA, hosting registration, the CRI, which is an AI service out of Wisconsin, all our animals are ID'd. With the U.S. Department of Ag is talking about coming on, they're talking about with the new ear tags. It's almost like the GPS they want to implant it on all the dairy animals across the United States. Hopefully we can work something out. But I know it's going to be cheap. Colin Peterson said this morning, and from his district, he said they were talking about $170 million implementation coming up now pretty quick for federal funding on this for cross-border animals. I don't know whether beef's going to be included in this program or not. I'm not sure where they're coming from.
Mr. Bray.
Well, Madam Chair, it's an issue that's been in our industry for some time. We've pushed for a voluntary animal identification system for many years. The word mandatory always makes people a little skeptical, and who's going to run it? Will it be a private group? Will it be government? How secure will it be? How much information will be allowed to be seen by people outside our industry? So those are all very legitimate concerns. Liability, if an animal is found to, for instance, cause a salmonella problem in our food supply, will I as a producer be held liable if they can trace that animal all the way back to my farm? There is a positive side to this identification system, is that it's a tool that producers can use to improve their herds, track what their animal is doing all the way from when it hits the ground to the processing facility. And it also is the only way that I think that country of origin labeling can be used effectively. Because in the original country of origin labeling law, it prohibited, did not allow a tracking system. I could never understand how you were going to do that except with a lot of paperwork, which we were going to be required to do and keep on our farms for up to 6 years after the animal was gone from our farm. But now with an electronic database, we'll be able to easily track those animals, and anyone who wishes to use a country of origin plan will be able to do so easily with this ID system. So I think this is the step that needed to be taken if we were ever going to see any benefit from COOL. So I think our industry will support an ID system as long as it's very secure and we have some say on how it's developed. And I think that should be done from within our industry.
Representative Penneth.
Now, thank you, Madam Chair. And this is, for Mr. Brake and maybe Kevin Elfring, but you know, you told about the cow or your beef that broke its leg. Now, from the set of facts that Kevin gave us, it says that a farm dressed carcass cannot be accepted unless assurances are given the animal was not a donor. Now, that was not a donor. Broke its leg. Am I right?
It's a donor.
That's a donor because it broke its leg?
Yeah. Well, if it can't stand, if it couldn't walk itself into the plant,
yeah.
it would be considered ambulatory. But the fact that we put it down ourselves, it was not able to walk into the plant.
Yeah.
So that eliminated that. But I've made many contacts in Washington with our congressmen, our senators, Department of Ag, told them about the issue. There were several other things that happened since then, and I believe that in the final rule, we will be allowed to do that because of the efforts that we've taken to change that.
Well, a little common sense would be good.
Well, you got to remember who we're talking about, common sense.
Representative Hyde Gerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Vinas. I agree with you, and it's a major concern in my area. I have a lot of farmers that complain to me about that, but there's nothing that really they can do. But getting to, I want to readdress something you brought back to me, and I'll bring back to you in regards to food safety, Mr. Brake. I come from representing Magnus's district, so you have my sympathy.
No, I don't.
Thank you. But anyways, my point being that 99%, I feel, of the beef slaughtered by my local processors comes locally grown. It's not coming from out of state. It's not coming out of the country. One of the problems I dealt with when I bought the restaurant is I had a major supplier that I found out after being in business a couple of weeks was Dutch-owned. It was a transaction of over $100,000. I dropped a $100,000 contract with this company, being that a lot of the products were coming from foreign-grown products. And I switched to a local, a company more local, and I don't want to mention the name. But my point being that it is still safer, the point I'm giving, buying that beef from a local processor than it is buying from, say, a large conglomerate like Cut Foods. That's the point I was trying to make. Thank you.
And I agree, Representative, that I feel that my beef is the safest in the world. Mm-hmm. But I represent the whole state of cattlemen that come from all corners of the state. And I want people to be assured that all beef is safe, no matter what part of the country or state it comes from. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think when you take the risk of telling people that meat from this, for instance, there was in South Dakota when this happened, they were giving away beef gift certificates saying that you could only buy South Dakota beef because they were giving the message that beef from the state of Washington was not safe. Mm-hmm. And I called up the president of South Dakota Cattlemen and said, you're giving the wrong message.
Mm-hmm.
Beef in this country is still safe. That's what we have to tell consumers. We have to convince them, if we're going to stay in business, that they have to keep eating this, because there are other countries that close their borders. We have to get people here to eat about 10% more. So I'm just trying to get the message out that all beef in this country is produced safely.
Representative Magnus.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm offended by Representative High Gerken's remark.
Could you take up this matter after the committee?
Well, okay, I will. Because I think the beef processed in my home area is better than his or your home area. But
I have trouble seeing the difference. It's so cool.
That's what I'm trying to show, Madam Chair. But we'll explain that to Bud later.
Part of the part is as I've looked at this, and we've worked with this a long time, and you, Madam Chair, and Steve, and some of the others, Dr. Hartman, and others. You know, there's an important export market to the United States, even though it's only 10% of what we of the beef we produce here. We export. It's still very, very important, and I think. When you're trying to deal with the two largest markets we have for beef in Japan and South Korea, knowing the cultures there, it's a very difficult market to change, because at the same time, many of our groups here were calling for the U.S. and our trading partners to stick strictly by the international rules, which would force them to not allow imported beef from Canada for 7 years. The same people now squawking about some of the steps that we're trying to take here in the U.S. to recapture our export market in less than the 7 years. And I think we're seeing the efforts from the Food and Drug Administration and the USDA as they attempt to open these markets up, because some of those people that have been to Japan and South Korea are very close friends of mine, and certainly know the export market, certainly know the domestic situation. But I hate to see them take steps that go overboard to either reassure our domestic market here of the safety of beef, but also do some things that I think in the long term are not beneficial to our industry in order to capture the export market. So I'm glad to see that the analysis that our presenters have had today of some of the things, for example, the situation where if a cow, an animal breaks its leg as you're loading it, and you can't take it to your local processor and consume the meat yourself, is not going to make the final cut in recommendations. That's a positive, common sense step, I think. And I hope we're learning from what Europe has gone through. I was there during the last BSE scare, and I can tell you the day that it hit, the next day, there were signs everywhere in the restaurants all over Europe promoting Argentine beef in their restaurants. That was all that was being served. They imported a lot of beef that night, I know, from Argentina, but not all of it that night. And I've been to Argentina many times also, and they have a different tasting beef because it's a grass-fed, forage-fed beef. And what I had in Europe wasn't Argentine beef that I've been used to. So we have to be cautious again about going overboard, I think, and trying to use, in the USDA's terms, an abundance of caution. I think they used an overabundance of caution. And I would ask that the members of the committee, Madam Chair, do follow that way of thinking as we go through the session here, and really look at attempts that may be made by some groups and some of our federal legislators to head down a path that is not a wise, not a common sense path, and not wise to support agriculture here in the state.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Bakerberg.
I have one more comment. I know many of the Downers came in. I see there's another dairy farmer on your committee there. We have Downers more than just broken legs. They're healthy animals. We lose them from milk fever. We lose them from calving problems. And they're a healthy animal. And you're also eligible for slaughter. There's nothing wrong with the animal. So when the USDA banned all Downer cows overnight, it came out great from the public's eye. But it did a tremendous harm to a lot of dairy farmers throughout the United States at that time. Like I said, there was approximately 20,000 Downer cows slaughtered a year across the United States. I mean, that's a lot of animals. I mean, that's just one or two. It's a lot of animals, and they got banned. You can't do nothing with them. And the rendering processes there right now, they don't know what to do with them either, because they're running out of room. So what do you do with a Downer cow? Butcher and just throw out and pour in the weeds? I'm not sure after you get rid of them, the rendering plants won't take them.
Mr. Bakerberg, could you estimate what percentage of your annual income or receipts for your operation are affected by this measure, if you're not able to salvage, have salvage value?
Madam Chair, last year we sold five cows of our 70 cow herd that went downers, and they were hauled off to a processing plant that bought that to buy downer cows. Where they went, I'm not sure whether they went to animal use or. And what we were told, that a good part of the cows were taken and used for human consumption. They were USDA-inspected plants they were taken to. And obviously, each cow is worth probably $700. So I'm saying about $4,000 for the products went out there.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Gray.
To the whole country, to the industry, it's about $500 million a year.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your making yourselves available for this issue today.
Thank you for inviting us down here.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just would like to comment and publicly thank two businesses in St. Paul here who accommodated our committee. We had hoped that more might be interested in this educational experience we had of touring a beef processing plant and a rendering facility. It gives me tremendous confidence in the way our meat supply is processed, and assures me of its cleanliness and safety and the professional way it's handled. And the rendering facility, I guess, was striking to me, as we need to recognize that this industry is an important part of the entire meat industry cycle in bringing and being one of the first recyclers in our country, as they recover valuable nutrients for reuse. And so some of those of us who went on the tour will have that in our minds, as well as we deal with some of these issues in this industry. So I do want to publicly thank Dakota Premium Beef and Animax for making their businesses available to our committee and being very accommodating and providing a very educational experience for those who took advantage of it. If there are no further comments or questions, our next hearing will be on the 17th of February. We'll be looking at bonding proposals. And until then, this meeting is adjourned.